right. Over the course of this talk, which will be significantly shorter than Keith's, I will try to explain to you why a slingshot is an apt metaphor for what I am about to describe. Basically, what I'm about to describe is a mechanism for arranging for the initial conditions for inflation in a situation where you might not happen to be in the right part of the phase space diagram for the inflaton field. And I will try to convince you, although there exist, of course, other methods of doing this, that this might actually have some interesting observable features by the end of the talk. Keep this, I think this is one of the Balearic slingers, famous in antiquity. Keep the slinger in mind. The slinger will come back. And this is, again, based on work done with Keith Dienis, and who is in the room, and Jeff Kost, who is not in the room. Okay.
But watching,
I'm sure. Okay. So, initial conditions for inflation. If we want to get a prolonged period of accelerated expansion of the universe, and this is the inflationary idea, the inflaton potential, V of phi, and we're just going to consider V of phi, this is the potential here, must satisfy the slow roll criteria. So, of course, you folks all know this. Here they are. This one achieves slow roll. This achieves slow roll for a prolonged duration. And successful inflation is contingent here, not just on the shape of the potential, I want to emphasize, but on having the appropriate initial conditions. So we've got to be in the right region of phi, phi dot space. So, for example, I will, for a lot of this talk, take quadratic inflation just as an example. Again, that's all it is, an example. This works for a lot of other kinds of potentials, too, in principle. So basically, here's my potential, here's a parabola, and basically, you can be in many, if your field can start in many different places. Let's just assume that phi dot is zero for the moment. So here, quantum gravity regime, here, eternal regime, this purple region. Here, within this regime, sufficient for slow roll inflation, but once we get down here, things are either dependent on the initial velocity as to whether you can achieve sufficient e-folds of inflation, or you get none, no inflation at all, or insufficient inflation when you're all the way down here, regardless of your initial velocity. So the initial conditions do matter. Okay, so appropriate initial conditions, there are, of course, ways of achieving these. Chaotic inflation is one, natural inflation is another. These have natural mechanisms to get you in the right region of field space. However, might we be able to salvage regions of phase space that might not give rise to successful inflation? In other words, here is my, you know, if I have here phi dot on this axis, phi on this axis, this is kind of the phase space diagram for the inflaton. You see the attractors here. If, you know, the inflaton field starts here, it will go down here, join the attractor, and go in here eventually. That's all great if you're in this blue region where things, where you get sufficient numbers of e-folds of inflation. Here you get inflation in these gray regions, but not a sufficient number of e-folds, any n greater than 50 or 60. And in here you get no inflation at all. Let's say you happen to start around here. Are there mechanisms that can dynamically propel you with the right initial conditions initial conditions for inflation so that you can start? Yeah.
Why is it you don't get inflation in that red strip? Because you have very large amplitudes, because you have very large velocity, and then you are breaking a slow roll or something.
Yeah. Well, for the large velocities, yeah. I mean, if you're in here, you just
no. There is clear.
Right. Right.
Large amplitude is what I have the doubt.
Yeah.
The large velocity is poised enough e-folds because you will reach the minimum too soon. No?
Yep.
You'll hit the attractor too close in. To the middle.
Right.
What if the attractor far out, so you have enough
folds?
It doesn't happen.
Yeah. Okay. So the answer, of course, is yes, or I wouldn't be giving this talk. So let's see what that mechanism is. So there are going to be a couple of ingredients in this mechanism which I'm going to propose. And the first is phase transitions. So additional light scalars, these are a common feature of many theories beyond the standard model, and such fields are often light, these additional fields, because they're protected from gaining masses by some sort of symmetry. Classical symmetries can be broken at the quantum level, for example, by non-perturbative effects, so you can get a small but non-zero mass later on for fields like axions or axion-like particles. The QCD axion, of course, is a canonical example, but you can do this for many other axion-like particles. Gary talked about this, other people have talked about this as well. Okay, so basically you tilt your axion potential and you end up getting something that looks at least to lowest order, roughly sinusoidal. Okay, now, important thing to mention here. This is dynamical. Scalar masses that are generated in this way, this means they are time dependent. So they evolve dynamically over the course of the phase transition. So for example, if we're generating a mass for one of these fields, it is going to evolve non-trivially in time. And as we're going to see, that non-trivial time dependence is going to play an important role in our slingshot mechanism. So, the dynamics of the phase transition, and this is, we've studied, Keith, Jeff, and I have studied this in other papers before. So, what we're going to consider is a mass squared matrix that has a form like this. So, mass squared matrix, diagonal here, prior to the phase transition, zero, and then some mass m squared, large mass. If you wonder where this comes from in terms of naturalness or something, think of this as a truncation of a KK tower, for example, if I were to add more and more and more masses, fields with higher and higher masses down here. Then, during the phase transition, additional contributions to the mass matrix show up, and in general, we can parameterize them, so we assume that these are symmetric, of course. And so here's, in general, what these things look like. These are all functions of time. And for the rest of the talk, we're going to use bars on top of different quantities to connote late time values to that into which things settle asymptotically after the phase transition is effectively over. So those are the bars. So basically, we have these masses are equal to this late time mass, parameterize them times some uniform function here, which is perfectly, this is common, happens during a lot of kinds of phase transitions, where you have a uniform time dependence for all of these different textures. And so we adopt a particular function which is designed to kind of model or mock up fairly well what happens with the QCD phase transition while still being a nice, neat analytic function that we can write down. So this is our function H, this red dashed line, and this is what it actually looks like if you do the numerics for, say, a QCD axion. Okay, these masses, however, it'll be easier to work in terms of another set of parameters, so I'm going to define a slightly different parameterization here. We're going to define a mass called M sum, where M sum squared is equal to the sum of these masses, and two parameters, alpha and beta right here. So here's alpha, basically m squared minus these two diagonal masses over m squared plus these two diagonal masses, and then here's beta. So basically this is another way of parameterizing things. As we'll see, this will be a useful way of doing that. And in order that m squared is always positive semi-definite, it turns out that we basically need to impose these conditions on these three variables. Okay. That's just the parameterization. Now let's see how the masses evolve in a system like this. So mass squared eigenvalues here for, we'll call these lambda. So lambda naught will be the lightest one, lambda 1 will be the heavier one. So there are only two fields here. And basically the mass squared eigenvalues can be written like this in terms of these parameters that we've written down. And it turns out that as the universe evolves and you turn on the phase transition, it's kind of interesting how these mass eigenvalues and how the parameters here, how everything evolves. So basically what I'm showing in this plot is, so I've got the parameters alpha and beta on this axis, and we're fixing a particular value of m sum here. And essentially, for this particular value of m sum that we've chosen, you'll notice that effectively, what these lines are, these are sort of flow lines within this parameter space of alpha and beta, along which the system evolves as time goes on. Now, the we could start in any given place, we could stop in any given place, but the point is that we're always, regardless of whether we start where we start or stop, we're always going along these lines. Now, what about the actual mass eigenvalues here? Well, you'll notice that we've got these little sort of, these here are contours of lambda, not the lightest of the mass eigenvalues here, the lightest of the two mass eigenvalues. And you'll notice that as the system evolves, if it starts, for example, up here and goes through this region of the plot and down here, and it kind of does this generically throughout this whole region of the plot here, as long as we start from somewhere over here, lambda naught evolves non-monotonically in time. We go, this green line is sort of the peak value of lambda naught that we go through as the system evolves in this way. And as a result, what we get is sort of a non-monotonic pulse or peak in lambda naught. So this mass eigenvalue is actually going up and then going down as we go forward in time. Okay, so what are the consequences of this non-monotonicity? Well, there are two of them that are important. The first is something that we call reover damping. So basically, the way, just to review it, the way the energy density of a scalar, the background value of a scalar, evolves, goes like, there are basically two different regimes here. So basically, what determines how the background value behaves and how it scales with the evolution of the universe is basically the relationship between h, the Hubble parameter, and the mass. If 3h is greater than around 2 lambda naught, the system's overdamped, it behaves like vacuum energy. If 3h is less than 2 lambda naught, it's underdamped, behaves like massive matter. It's like the axion background oscillating. So a typical field will behave like vacuum energy at early times and like matter at later times. But that assumes that the mass is fixed, or at least monotonically evolving. When we have a non-monotonic evolution of mass, we can have a situation here where the field starts out in an overdamped regime, then the mass increases here so that 3h is now less than 2 lambda naught, and we are underdamped. Then we go back to a re-overdamped regime. So we are overdamped, underdamped, then overdamped, and then, of course, at very late times again, after the phase transition is done and things have settled into their late-time asymptotic masses, then we go back to underdamped again, and we're oscillating. But the point is that we go through a long period after initial underdamping of being overdamped, scaling like, functioning like vacuum energy again. And this period here is going to be the period that turns out to be inflationary in this scenario. Okay, so the second consequence of non-monotonicity is parametric resonances. Now, when everybody thinks of inflation and parametric resonances, everybody suddenly immediately goes, oh yeah, preheating, I know that. Okay, no, these are not the same kinds of parametric resonances. This is a totally different parametric resonance, and so I want to disabuse you of that notion right off the bat. What is this parametric resonance? Well, we saw that there's a pulse behavior in lambda naught, where it rises and falls during the phase transition over a particular time scale. So if we take this pulse, you can kind of mock it up a little bit with a sine wave, if you will. This is just to kind of motivate it. So there's kind of a frequency at which the mass eigenvalue is changing. So here's one frequency, one time scale in the problem. And you can figure out what that frequency is if we're mocking this up by a sine or a cosine. Well, here's the function we're fitting here. Just take a couple of derivatives of this so we get with respect to time and divide it by this thing and we can isolate what the frequency is. So this is why there's a lambda double dot there. So this is our effective frequency here. Basically tells you about the curvature of this at the peak. Okay. Now, where's our other time scale? We need two time scales for resonance. Well, the other time scale is, of course, the mass of the lightest field itself. So if we take this thing squared and compare it to lambda naught squared, in other words, if we take this and divide it by this omega effective squared divided by lambda naught squared. It turns out in this system, so this is standard oscillator with a time varying mass, the resonance condition here is that this ratio here is equal to 1 over n squared, where n is an integer. So positive integer, 1, 2, 3, etc.
So naively, if the mass is changing, then the resonating seems to be difficult. We need some coherent situation, right?
Okay. Believe it or not, I'm about to show you your. Can I rephrase your question back to you and tell me I've got a pulse right here. This is not even an oscillation. This is half an oscillation.
Okay. Maybe I should wait.
Yeah. Is this enough? You might be skeptical. Watch. I was skeptical too at first, but watch. So, Yuko's question, is half an oscillation enough? Here, let's track what the energy densities of these fields actually are. But let's start with the field values themselves. So here's phi lambda naught here. This is just the field value of this field. The interplay between these two effects turns out, even though we've just got half a cosine wave, can propel the field to a large field value. And the phase transition, so basically we'll carry the field here through n over 2 oscillations and then releases it at maximum velocity phi dot lambda naught into the re-overdamped phase. So the field trajectories, I'm adjusting here the width of the phase transition. So there's a sort of width in time for the phase transition. That characteristic time scale, we'll call that delta G. This is part of this H function that I defined earlier on. If we adjust that so that things are on resonance, and I'll come back to how much adjusting you need to do, how much fine-tuning you need in a minute. Basically, so here's n equals 1, we just go whoop like that, n equal 2, so whoop like that, n equal 3, beep, like that, n equal 4, you get the idea. So, and notice though, the phi value here is really being launched. It's being launched to pretty big values. In other words, what we're doing is we're kind of letting this field oscillate up and down a couple times and then release. So, in other words, it's a slingshot, and hence the origin of the name. So, it really is kind of functioning like a sling here.
Sorry, what controls n?
Oh, Evangelos first, and then
what
n.
What controls n?
What controls n? N is just the number of the resonance. So, if it happens to be that the width of the phase transition aligns with the mass at one of those resonant points, then this is what you get. That's the end.
So I'm a bit confused, and maybe it's just a misunderstanding I'm having about the issue of homogeneity and isotropy here. Because somehow, if I'm understanding correctly, you are engineering this system to happen before inflation, to give initial conditions to inflation. But somehow you are already assuming a homogeneous and isotropic universe, aren't you? Maybe I misunderstood this, but somehow you are giving the initial condition to a slingshot, the inflaton amplitude, to very large amplitudes, but we are already in a homogeneous and isotropic situation. Or am I misunderstanding this? And connected to this question, which would refer maybe to the first consequence you were referring to, the second one, normally when I think of resonance of whatever kind, this affects differently depending on the momenta, but here you're only talking about the homogeneous mode. Is this correct?
So here we're only talking about the homogeneous mode. I'll talk a little bit about perturbations later on, again, as far as the homogeneity and isotropy of the universe goes, so again, what we have here early on, I mean, there, you can have some perturbations, whatever. What we have, we're talking about the zero mode of a field here. So basically, all what we have really is something that functions as a homogeneous background mode. We can have little perturbations on top of it. These are things, this whole perturbation thing is kind of the next thing that we're working on to working on the study here. I'll talk a little bit about what we expect to be a little bit different in terms of inhomogeneities, but let's defer that till the end. There are a few slides at the end that I think will address this a little bit better before I punt. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay.
But nothing here requires.
Nothing here requires it, yeah.
Sort of, I mean, you had also the plot of Hubble. What are you assuming is the dominant energy density while this thing?
Good question. That we can wait one slide or two slides, I forget which, until we get. Okay. One slide. All right. So, evolution of the scalar sector. So, basically, now we kind of have to get the lay of the land here now that we have our mechanism developed as to what we're going to assume as initial conditions and what we're going to put in our universe. So, basically, what we are going to put in our universe is our phi particles, and then since we have a phase transition here, there should be some additional sector of the theory that exists to be able to give rise to the phase transition. A natural thing would be radiation, a radiation bath, right? So what we're going to assume is that there is a radiation bath, and that we're radiation dominated at very early times. And I'm going to plot now a bunch of different attributes of the universe over the during this slingshots operation here, in terms of what's going on with all of the different field components. So, given your questions, let's start by zeroing in on the energy densities here. This is a little bit reversed from the way the slides are going to go, but what the heck. Okay, so energy densities here. Red is this radiation component. So we start radiation dominated early on. The radiation is just going to go down, it's going to tank, and then here is rho of lambda naught, so going up like that and doing its thing. Here is rho of lambda 1. Plotting these things, so again, plotting lambda 1 and lambda naught before this point here is a little bit disingenuous because lambda naught and lambda 1 are kind of coupled to each other. The mass matrix is changing, and it's not really easy to separate the two. So in this dashed line, I'm just plotting the sum of the two. And this just maps right onto here, right onto the blue curve, because this is just so much higher. This is a log scale than the black. Okay, so the blue is going to be our inflaton, and its energy density sort of goes down like this, and then across. Phi 1 is the heavier field. It goes down, but again, not as fast as radiation. And these dashed and dotted lines here just represent different amounts of radiation that you could have. So these are just two different cases earlier on. So now let's take a look at the actual, first of all, the masses of the fields. The interesting thing that's going on here is just lambda naught going on and doing this, and then basically after this point, its mass is basically constant. Just here's to compare to Hubble, so you know when things are overdamped and when things are underdamped. Here, we're looking at what the field values are. So the field values, lambda 1, this is phi lambda 1. It's just basically along the x-axis, and this is the heavier field. The lighter field, though, these are for different values of the resonance number. So these are this is basically what happens to the lighter field. So it's getting slingshotted to pretty big field values. These are all in units of M. Planck. And then this is W for the entire universe. This is the equation of state. And so here's W for the whole universe, and here's W for the scalar fields, the scalar sector, phi 1 and phi naught. And you can see here that during this part of the universe, W really is looking a lot like minus 1. So we really are functioning like vacuum energy. Okay, and so basically I've narrated this in opposite order by audience fiat, so here we go. The point is that in this way, we do have a long period of time here where we have the field being, it's still overdamped, we are functioning like vacuum energy here, and indeed this is acting like an inflaton. Okay, either one of you who wants to go first, Danny.
I'm just curious, what is the Keynesian-dominated era story?
Okay. So the Keynesian-dominated era, once I launch this field to a very large field value, well, this is a big phi dot.
So it's the velocity.
Exactly. So there's a big phi dot, but of course that kinetic energy dissipates very rapidly. So it, so basically the field kind of goes like, and then kind of sticks.
Then I'm a bit curious about energy conservation, how it works here. Because where are you getting the energy in first place that you are imparting to this guy, you know? And where is this energy coming from?
Okay, so good. This is a tricky thing, and this is cutting to, so basically, where is this coming from? So this is coming from, effectively this would come from the radiation sector as we're doing the phase transition. Now, you might wonder about tuning and issues like this. Yes, there is some tuning involved. However, what I would claim is that this is exactly the tuning that is commensurate with getting the right cosmological constant now. So, in other words, yes, there's a fine tuning, but it's not a new one.
It looks like it's exactly the constant problem, which we're assuming is solved somehow.
Yeah.
Looks like exceeding radiation energy density. Red one is.
So wait, say it again about the radiation?
So the summation looks like exceeding radiation energy.
Once we get to here, yeah, but the radiation, so this is when during the phase transition this is happening. So radiation starts ahead.
Yeah. If it's energy transfer, I would guess that the total.
But the masses are changing, so there's an external thing driving the system. So
yeah, but that energy has to come from somewhere.
Right.
But I mean, it's external. It's an external thing.
In regular parametric resonance, you have to. I mean, you can do the calculations, but at the end of the day, you have to check that the energy you suck from the inflaton is not bigger than the energy the inflaton had to give in the first place.
Yes.
So in order for the calculations to, I guess, to hold, the final energy density once you reach that plateau and you stop has to be much smaller than the energy density you started with.
And you wouldn't believe how computationally annoying it is to check that.
Energy is conserved throughout. This was a horrible miracle.
Oh my, yes.
It is correct.
Yeah. And you had.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, two questions, I guess. One related to there. So let me ask the first one. It's easier.
Yeah.
Have you checked if phi dot is always smaller than M plus? Because it seems like you're slingshotting pretty fast in terms of the scale factor to a value that is significantly above M plus. So I would imagine that maybe phi dot is actually going above or very close to M plus at that point.
I think we have checked that, haven't we? Yeah, I'm pretty sure we have.
You'll see the plot.
Yeah, actually, yeah, you will come to
say infinity bigger than Planckian.
The
kinetic energy won't be, but the field value.
The kinetic energy.
You were saying phi dot versus
phi dot. So phi dot
squared versus Planck force, right?
Phi will be super.
No, phi dot squared versus Planck to the force.
Planck squared. I think it's compare the dimension correct.
Yeah, phi is what will be.
Because it seems like sort of within the scale factor of 3 or 4, you're going above M block, so it seems like phi dot should be.
We're close. Okay. Let's see. And how do I advance? Okay. So, well, don't worry. We'll get back to these things. They're a couple slides away. Okay. So, mapping to inflationary quantities. So you've kind of seen just in print. This kind of is an illustration of principle, but the numbers. Okay, we're getting to phi equals 8 or whatever. What is that? How far can we actually get? So in general, we can construct a map between the parameters of our model and the initial conditions for the inflaton field. There are certain regions of parameter space that turn out, of course, to be more useful than others. These are the regions where there's substantial mixing, which means this parameter beta, the late time version, beta bar, is a lot less than 1, and the late time inflaton mass is small in Planck units and much smaller than m squared. Also, we want the width of the phase transition to be at least approximately on resonance here, So it's got to be near one of the resonant values that would give us this slingshot. But it turns out actually that you don't really need a lot of fine tuning here. In fact, you actually need a lot of fine tuning not to get this to work. This is as a function of delta G, this sort of width of the phase transition. This is what you get for phi at the onset of inflation, kind of after the slingshot has taken place. You'll notice that really these are not narrow spiky resonances. These are pretty broad, and you actually have to be, you know, somewhere around here to get things to be really suppressed. So this is actually pretty robust, even though there's a resonance condition. Okay, so the number of e-folds of inflation. So we can compute this across the parameter space of our model. So here for three different values of lambda naught bar, 10 to the minus 5 in Planck units, 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 9, as a function of 1 minus alpha bar here and m squared sum bar over m squared. You'll notice that as we get to smaller and smaller lambda naught bars, we get higher and higher. So these are contours of the number of e-folds, n or n-inf. So here we can get up to 7 or 8. Here we can get up to 19. Here we can get up to, we're up to like 36 right here. So we'll see again how far we can actually get. So another thing that I want to point out here is these red contours here. These are contours of a ratio that we call Q, script Q, which is lambda naught mass of the pulse at the peak of, so when we're doing that non-monotonic peak in lambda naught, this is what the mass is at the peak, divided by the late time asymptotic mass. And it turns out that within this region here, so there's obviously this region here, which is the most advantageous for inflation, for number getting the highest number of e-folds, that there's a little bit of a correlation with this Q ratio, at least in this regime. By the way, when you get further higher here than this, what's happening and why you're not getting a lot of e-folds anymore is over here, that's where phi 1, that field, is plays a dominant role in contributing to the energy density of the universe after the slingshot, and so that's going to suppress inflation. Okay, so these are the optimal regions. How optimal can we make them? So how high can we get? Well, as I said, typically this parameter Q plays a big role within those regions as to how big things can get. It turns out that the value of phi, the field value at the onset of inflation, basically is given by this Lambert W function of a few parameters here, but one of them is Q, this ratio that I talked about. A phi, which is the initial field value of phi naught. So taking it to just be 1 M Planck, which is insufficient for inflation until we do the slingshot, we find that the corresponding number of e-folds of inflation is approximately this function of Q. This is why this Q parameter is important. And if you actually do a full numerical calculation, first of all, so full numerical calculation is these solid curves. This formula are these dotted curves. These are for different values of the initial field value way, way, way back before the slingshot. And this is the infilton field value that we get, and then the corresponding number of e-folds. Notice that we do a very good job of modeling it with this lower on, but when we get to very high values of Q, there's a plateau. And the interesting thing is this plateau in the number of e-folds is right above the number that you would need for inflation. Interesting. This actually could have some interesting phenomenological consequences. Danny's already sort of shaking his head because he already asked about perturbation, so he has put two and two together. But anyhow, we'll come back to this in a minute. But the interesting thing is that we can get enough e-folds for inflation, but just enough. Okay. By the way, if we start with some initial field velocities, you might wonder whether this gets disturbed. It actually depends a little bit on, for example, the signs of the field velocities. You can engineer situations where if you have a phi, the initial value of the field, and the initial velocity having the opposite sign or something, you can basically cancel things out. But really, for most values of phi naught, things are pretty robust. So even if you have some non-zero velocity, it doesn't spoil anything. The field doesn't have to be sitting there before inflation. Okay, so inflationary observables. What do we get out of this? Now, the slingshot, keep in mind, we just have, at the end of the slingshot, we have a light field that has a mass, right? So up to, you know, whatever anharmonic corrections you might want to throw into it or whatever later on at the end of the day, like you would with an axion, really, mostly, this is quadratic inflation. That's all it is. So everything parameter, you know, everything in terms of the phenomenology, more or less, follows just like quadratic inflation does. So for the power spectra for scalar and tensor perturbations, parameterize them in the normal way. Quantities like the tensor to scalar ratio, the spectral index, all of this, same as in other models of quadratic inflation. By contrast, A sub S, the coefficient here of the scalar perturbation spectrum, also depends on the scale of inflation, or in our scenario, on the late time inflaton mass. So basically is given by this. Planck data, if you take a pivot scale to be 0.05 megaparsecs to the minus one, this basically yields A sub S being this. This implies that we need to have a pretty light lambda naught. Some tension exists between this bound and the bound on nInf, but it can be reconciled in many ways. You can introduce a curviton, modifications to the potential, stuff like that. So, okay. Now, a couple of other things. So, particle production. The masses, we should check, since the masses of our scalars change fairly abruptly during the phase transition, we have this big, you know, whoop thing going on. Is this going to, this is clearly a non-adiabatic process. It can lead to the production of the inflaton field quanta. We should check. And indeed, we do evaluate the Bogle-Yubov coefficients. So many people have talked about this at the conference here. I'm not even going to bother to bring that up. These turn out to be mathematically equivalent in this case to the transmission coefficients for scattering off a particular potential that looks like this in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. This allows you to basically calculate the energy density, so total energy density of the background fields, total energy density of the inflaton quanta divided by this is given by this. This gives you a constraint on Q. This is a non-trivial constraint, but it's one that we can easily satisfy. So this is not too much of a problem. Okay, so just to summarize, and then I'm going to get to some of the things that people have asked. In this talk, we presented a novel mechanism for realizing the initial conditions for cosmic inflation, and we did it in only about 40 minutes. This mechanism can be realized in theories involving multiple scalar fields with a cosmological phase transition, where that phase transition dynamically gives rise to to additional contributions to the scalar mass matrix. Time-dependent mixing arises as a result of the phase transition. This gives rise to parametric resonances in turn and a period of re-over damping. So these together give rise to give us our slingshot mechanism, which propels the VEV of the lighter field to larger values and precipitates a subsequent epoch of accelerated expansion. And this scenario we've seen is capable of yielding an appropriate number of E-folds for successful cosmic inflation. Future possible directions. So first of all, while this is challenging to realize or arrange in practice, it may be possible to drive the inflaton VEV to higher values by having multiple successive slingshots, one on top of the other. For various reasons, this gets really hard because your one slingshot can spoil initial conditions for another one, but maybe there are ways around this. It would be interesting to generalize the results that we get for quadratic inflation to more general functional forms of V. Quartic inflation, other things, in scenarios in which, this kind of gets to the point of interesting things that might go on with the perturbations. So in scenarios where I have just enough inflation, and yes, I am referencing that paper here, the initial conditions which determine the spectrum of large-scale perturbations before inflation do differ from the Bunch-Davies vacuum, what you get from the Bunch-Davies vacuum. So this could have potentially observable consequences, and it would be interesting to explore those. That's something that we're kind of working on right now. And the presence of additional heavy fields can also affect, because we have that phi 1 also, right, can affect the pattern of non-Gaussianities, and this could potentially give rise to interesting quote-unquote cosmological collider signals. So thanks, and that is the last slide. Okay. Angelus and then Jonathan, or the other direction, or whoever.
Okay, so two things about the going up. So first of all, if I imagine myself being up the hill and then just starting rolling, then I expect a suppression of the power at low scales because my 5 dot is smaller. But also, related to Danny's question, I think that was that where he was going. The fact that you get this parametric resonance for k equals 0, probably you get parametric resonance for a bunch of k modes. So when you jump up the potential, it's highly likely that you jump up not as a condensate, but as a very homogeneous mass. So that probably puts huge power on large scales, right? Is that what you're thinking about now, or?
That is one of the things that we're thinking about, yeah, about now, is what happens to all the light modes which have, you know, very, 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 very large K, super Planckian, things like that. Yes, that is one of the things that we're thinking about.
That was my concern, yeah.
Okay, that is also your concern. Well, okay, cool. Yes, that's one of the things that we're looking at right now. Jonathan?
So you have two fields here. So how much of this mechanism is from the fact you've actually changed the mass eigenstates, and how much is from the fact that you're rotating the eigenbases? Because an easy way to get a kick is just say I'm rolling down some steep direction, and right when I hit the minimum, I rotate into a like direction and I just go way, way out. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
Is this what's happening here? And then, you know, if you go up and then rotate, you'll come up the other way.
Yeah.
Or is it actually a kick because of the mass changing?
It is actually a kick because of the mass changing. Because really, the potential for these fields is really time dependent. You are growing a potential under. You are really growing a potential under you, and so the masses for these fields, the shape of the potential itself, is actually a time dependent quantity. So it's not just where you are.
It's also the orientation.
The orientation also does matter, yeah. But so it's, again, that's important, but it is the interplay of those two things that gives rise to this. So that is a crucial ingredient. It's not just the same as rolling around in a potential. Gary?
I must be missing something very basic. So you wrote out a mass matrix, mm-hmm. at every point in view space, presumably. It changes as you go along. So what forbids tachyonic directions? If I write a random mass matrix, there are a lot of unstable directions. So that would even give you more dramatic.
What forbids tachyonic directions? Oh, come on. Fingers go fast. What forbids tachyonic directions? This thing we put in by fiat.
Okay, but why?
Just for sake of basically exemplifying this very simple model. In a more general scenario, you could have more fields, you could have tachyonic directions, you could have all sorts of other stuff. We just didn't want to deal with that with this simple realization.
Right, but suppose you have
consider phase transitions that are physical and don't produce tachyons. Otherwise, we tried to be as absolutely general as possible. No other constraints. But go ahead.
The tachyonic direction is precisely what you would see in this waterfall effect potential. Right? It's very. If I give you a random matrix potential, the probability of a critical point being minimum is e to the minus n squared suppressed. It's very unlikely to get a positive direction in every single possible way.
Yeah, and so it would be really interesting to incorporate that into this. Yes. We just didn't for simplicity. That's the only reason. Yes. Good question?
Since you were mentioning about the QCD action, so in the case of QCD action, something similar happens. But this increase of the mass is basically that getting energy from the QCD matters, right? But that, it doesn't matter because the energy ratio between the axion and the QCD is like 10 to minus 12 or something. So we don't have to think that even if energy transfer happens, we don't have to consider the back reaction. But here, basically coming back to the question of the Danny's energy conservation, we have to solve consistently the Hubble parameter evolution, right?
That's absolutely so, right. Yeah.
like, probably there should be some constraints so that the reaction is reasonable.
Yeah, and there are. And we have looked at this. And
back reaction, yeah, is taken
into account here.
Ignore it.
Yeah, with.
But then if the energy density of the axion becomes very large compared to variation of other sectors, then we have to consider back reaction.
Absolutely. That's in here. Yeah.
There should also be a back reaction into the phase transition that's causing the time dependence of the mass, because that's the worry. That sort of you're extracting energy from the time dependence of the mass, but you're never putting back the fact that you're sucking out a lot of energy from that time dependence back into whatever is causing the parameters to change. You're not allowing that to be fed except gravitation on the phase transition. Because it would be pretty hard to calculate what's happening to the phase transition as I'm sucking out energy, as far as I understand.
We are conserving energy at all moments.
Yeah.
So this has been very carefully done. As the phase transition unfolds, the energy is being dissipated out, and it is being converted into the slingshot.
Okay.
And that is all been taken into account in the Hubble evolution and in the evolution of every other field, the damping, everything. And the only fine-tuning that was put in was the one that guarantees that at the end we have a negligible cosmological constant. So we've been very careful about it. You can't even solve it directly. You have to iteratively go back and do it again and run it again and run it again, iteratively find the right balance. That was done. So that's tantamount to the cosmological constant.
Yeah, is that what you're?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you show the slide about the particle production?
Yes. Oh, take me a while to get there. Oh, no, where are we? There we are.
Do you consider like a scenario that you know this scalar field couples to some matter field? Let's say you're not made a candidate. Can you produce it?
Okay. If the scalar field couples to
the
dark matter candidate?
Let's see, we
haven't looked at that here in this context. That would be an interesting that's an interesting idea.
We'll talk that.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, I guess there's a non-adiabatic production of any fields like the dark matter field, but this is happening at the start of inflation, right? So it'll suffer.
Yeah, there's always an inflationary epoch afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it would inflate away.
Right.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be the dark matter today, but that doesn't mean you couldn't produce. I don't know why it would be useful, I guess, if it's going to inflate away, but it would be there. The point was to make sure that the particle production did not sap too much energy out of the slingshot, so that the slingshot would still occur. And the basic point is that in normally these scenarios, you can't start with small field maps. And people go through all sorts of imaginings with quantum mechanical, all the universes, eternal inflation, all sorts of quantum mechanisms to make sure that you could start with large field maps. We were saying one does not necessarily have to go through that. This is a very classical, dynamical, first order, not even radiative, tree level,
classical
method of starting with a small field map, and just by the dynamics of the fields, it naturally kicks you. Maybe you can explain what's happening in terms of the first, the phase space diagram at the beginning.
Phase space diagram of.
There.
You just mean here?
Yeah. So we're starting from a location and then...
Yeah, so for example, let's say we're starting from somewhere in here. Basically what's going on is we're essentially being kicked out with an enormous velocity, something like that. And then...
Right, so we're kicking, the slingshot pushes you up onto a new trajectory line, which when it comes down along an attractor at a greater point. But the velocity, to answer the question you asked before, you see where plus one is, and that's in Planck units. It's not going to ever go above that point. So we're not going to have super, I may have said the wrong thing before. We're not going to have super Planckian velocities.
Field vibes, yes, but not velocities.
Right.
Coming back to Gary's question, would it not be easier to just turn the potential tachyonic for a little while, let the photon roll out, and then put the potential back over again, or you've misaligned the photon to some large field value?
It could potentially be interesting, yeah.
But in the context of the QCD axion, Kiske, Hargara, and Raymond Koh have been studying this as an explanation for how the axion might start at the top of the hill rather than why the misalignment angle might be pi for QCD axion.
So I would say it's certainly, there can be other scenarios like that one, which are interesting, they also work. The thing is that this comes out of a very simple thing. This is just two states having a phase transition that gives mass, and phase transitions exist, and they give mass. And we found that this we didn't have the idea of a slingshot and try to figure out how to make it. This came out of a two-state system based on some earlier work, and we said, my gosh, if that happens,
this could be the right initial conditions for inflation. This could be an inflaton.
Exactly.
This could work this way.
Exactly, as Brooks just said. The whole point is that this dynamics naturally gives you not only the parametric resonance, which pumps up the field with lots of energy, but then the release into an re-overdamped region that produces vacuum energy.
Yeah, within which the field functions as
we were able to produce the conditions for inflation by some pre-inflationary phase transition, very natural. So maybe there's a way to do something that makes the field tachyonic as well, the potential tachyonic. That would be exciting, but this is what came out of a very simple dynamic, so that's why we're talking about this.
Let me play organizer for a second.
All right.
We're done.
Yeah, no, I mean, let's keep the conversation going, but I think we have cookies and tea or something.
That sounds like a great plan.
So let's thank Keith and Brooks again.